We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you meditate, and five-star app Meditation Studio. I'm your host, Patricia Karpus. I'm really excited about today's guest, Dr. Ron Siegel, and what he has to say about pain. Ron, a psychologist and author, has been an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School for over 35 years. He's a longtime student and teacher of mindfulness meditation with a special emphasis on chronic pain. In fact, he created the recent meditation studio course called Transforming Pain. He's written and edited several books on the topic where he integrates mindfulness practices, aggressive rehabilitation, and mind-body approaches. In this interview, he describes the difference between primary and secondary pain, how to break the chronic pain cycle, and how we can develop our capacity to be with pain. He is quite a force. You can also see Ron along with me and journalist and filmmaker Shannon Harvey live this Friday, May 21st at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're at all curious about brain health, Muse is presenting this live Zoom event for all to join. I'll be chatting with Ron and Shannon about the ways meditation and mindfulness can transform our brain health and our overall well-being. Find out more and sign up at choosemuse.com/brainhealth. I would love to see you there. Now, here's Ron. Ron, it's great to have you on Untangle. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Yeah. So today we're going to talk about the topic of pain, and you're one of our experts in this area. And I wanted to start with understanding how you really became interested in studying chronic pain.
Well, I became interested as a patient, even though I was already a psychologist. I hadn't really looked into the topic a great deal professionally, but about 30 odd years ago, I spent 4.5 months flat on my back with a herniated disc diagnosis. And I was not a happy camper. In those days, the typical orthopedic advice was to stay horizontal as long as possible in the hopes that the disc would somehow heal. And if not, you could be a candidate for surgery, but the results of surgery were decidedly iffy. So I was following the doctor's advice and lying down and hoping to get better, and wasn't. In fact, I was getting more and more depressed, more and more agitated, and more focused on my distress about the pain and the pain itself. One day I had the thought that my profession was fairly sedentary, so I had some friends build basically a platform couch or a bed in both my private office and my clinic office, and I began a bizarre parody of the classical psychoanalytic scene. I would be lying down and my patients would be sitting up and wondering about my prognosis and my pathology. And this dragged on for days and then weeks. My wife at one point made the observation, and she's also a psychologist. She said, "You seem to complain a lot more of the pain every time that we have an argument." And I thought, oh, great, this is my penance for marrying a fellow psychologist. Here I have this clear orthopedic disorder, and she's interpreting it as a psychological problem. Worse, she's interpreting it in the context of our relationship. So I kept going, kept dragging myself to see patients in this bizarre circumstance. Then a friend of mine at work said, "You've got to talk to Linda." And Linda was a social worker who ran a residential treatment facility for adolescents, and she was very good at what she did. But I didn't think that she was going to know more about chronic back pain than the Harvard orthopedist that I was in contact with. But he kept being insistent. So one day I call up Linda and she said, "Oh, yeah, hi, Ron. I heard from John you had a back problem. What are you doing?" And I said, I'm lying down. It's all I ever do. I was a real peach at the time. And she said, why don't you get up and buy some groceries? Your wife will appreciate it. And I thought, what is this now? Some feminist cabal? I mean, I'm a postmodern guy. I'm perfectly at home buying groceries, but I was incapacitated. I was disabled. I couldn't even walk, no less buy groceries. She said, just do it. And she also explained her idea, which was then not widely held, that many of these disorders actually aren't about the discs or other structures of the back, but they're actually psychophysiological disorders, which means that they're caused by a complex loop of pain, fear, preoccupation with the pain, and how all of that might be tightening the muscles and actually making the pain worse. And her prescription was get up and move. Now, I wasn't about to go buy groceries, but I had an appointment coming up a couple of weeks hence with an orthopedic surgeon. I thought, before I see the surgeon, I think I'll just test this a bit. And I vowed to push myself walking a little bit more than usual. And up until then, I had realized that I could walk perhaps a city block. And at that point, I would get terrible shooting pain going down one of my legs. And I decided to test this and push a little further. So I walked my city block. And sure enough, right on cue, got the pain going down the leg. And I thought, all right, I'll try Linda's idea. I'll walk another block. I walked another city block. And to my utter amazement, now, in addition to the pain going down the first leg, I developed pain going down my other leg as well. And I thought, well, that was brilliant advice, Linda. But actually, it was, because according to the CAT scan, they weren't using MRIs clinically in those days. According to the CAT scan, the disc was herniated laterally, as they usually are. So I was supposed to have pain in the first leg, not supposed to have pain in the second leg. So how come I have pain in both legs? My first hypothesis was, now I've shattered my spine entirely and I'm done for. But my second thought was, maybe Linda's right. Maybe the pain isn't due to what I'm seeing on the CAT scan. Maybe it's due to these other complex psychophysiological loops that she was talking about. And I decided to, before I saw the surgeon, I'm just going to really test this. Pain or no pain, I'm going to get back into activity. 2 weeks later, I was fine. I still had some lingering pain, but I was sitting up to see my patients. I was able to go on long walks. I was starting to do yoga again. I was on my road to recovery. A year later, I was quite better. And I reflected on this and I thought, gee, I'm a psychologist. My trade involves understanding people's thoughts, people's feelings, and how those thoughts and feelings affect our behavior and might make our life either richer or quite problematic. And I realized it was a shift in understanding and a shift in my behavior that came from that understanding that really freed me in a matter of very few days from what had seemed like an intractable orthopedic disorder. So I started reading voraciously about this, started looking into who else has some inkling that these disorders can be psychophysiological. And I started teaming up with physicians who had the same idea. And out of it, we wound up writing a book together. We wrote a book called The Back Sense, A Revolutionary Approach to Halting the Cycle of Chronic Back Pain. And then I went on to treat many, many patients over the last decades with similar problems.
Well, let me ask you a question. There is this saying, pain is inevitable, suffering is not. And you're talking about the fact that you had this personal experience of being able to soften the secondary pain in order to actually cure the primary pain. It's a little bit confusing for some of us to even think about the difference between primary and secondary pain. And you mentioned a little bit about the chronic pain cycle. And in Buddhism, it's called the second arrow, right? You have your injury, and then there's the second arrow, which is the catastrophizing, all these things that you were doing. But can you talk more about the difference between primary pain and secondary pain? How would someone know which is which?
Sure. That's a great question. Primary pain refers to the pain sensations that we experience that are simply coming from something impinging on tissue somewhere in the body. So my thought was that the primary pain that I had was due to this herniated disc. That's not what I later concluded, but that's what I believed was happening. The secondary pain involves, if you will, the suffering. It's the bracing, wincing, grimacing, the hating it, the fighting it, the wishing it would stop, all of our emotional reactions to the pain. And if pain were due, let's say, to a tumor, let's say it's a benign tumor, just to make it not so psychologically challenging. But let's say I have pain due to a benign tumor, or I simply have pain due to having badly stubbed my toe. Primary pain is simply the moment-to-moment sensations of the pain. Secondary pain would be worrying about the tumor, worrying about the toe, maybe hating it, maybe being really upset that I couldn't really walk now and I had wanted to go hiking. It would be all of the emotional reactions against it. And one of the things that works universally in working with chronic pain is learning how to notice moment-to-moment pain sensations and then notice the enormous amount of resistance, aversion reactions, bracing, tensing, hating it that typically arises in response to this. Now, my particular story is a little bit complicated because, as it turns out, my primary pain wasn't actually due to the herniated disc. It wasn't due to something like a tumor or a stubbed toe. It was actually due to what we call psychophysiological processes. So what was happening in my personal story was, I don't know what started the pain originally. I actually think it was psychological factors. We can talk about that if we like. But once the pain got going, I was caught in a cycle in which I was so upset about the pain that that was causing my muscles to tense. Although it wasn't done consciously as an act of will or volition, but my body was tensing out of fear of the pain, and particularly of the implications of the pain for disability. And those tense muscles were actually enough to create primary pain sensations, on top of which I had the secondary reactions of, I hate this. Oh my God, will I ever be able to walk again? Am I ever going to be okay? As it turned out with my particular syndrome, and this is actually remarkably frequently the case when it comes to chronic back pain, as opposed to cancer-related pain or pain due to stubbed toes, the primary pain was actually psychophysiological. So in this situation, finding a way to work with the secondary pain, finding a way to not be so afraid of the pain and not do all that actually resolved the pain completely. In the case of the stubbed toe or the tumor, we can find ways to work with it so that there still is primary pain, but we're much less distressed, much less disturbed by it. When the primary pain is psychophysiological, as was my case, you can actually resolve the disorder completely in many circumstances.
What you're really talking about is the chronic pain cycle, this cycle that we get into. And in the course that we do together, you talk about how you can be with rather than fight your pain sensations. And it's a way to help to build your pain tolerance. Let's just be clear. A lot of these things we're talking about today aren't for acute pain. If you break your arm, you break your leg, we're really talking about chronic pain here.
We're mostly talking about chronic pain because chronic pain is what upsets most of us, right? Where acute pain, when we know we happen to be recording this right now during the phase of the pandemic where vaccines are coming out regularly and some of us have been vaccinated and we've had the experience of going for the vaccination and being told, this may hurt just for a moment when we get the injection, and then being told, you may feel achy or weak or have a headache, but it'll only last for about a day. When we expect pain to be time limited, most of us are pretty okay with it, unless it's excruciating, unless it's like a horrible toothache or something like that. If we know it's going to get better pretty soon, we can tough it out pretty easily. In fact, we can take analgesics that make it easier to tough it out.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, help.com/untangle. Now back to our show.
I'm a psychologist, and a lot of what we're talking about here is the power of our beliefs to really change our subjective experience and behavior. Will you talk a little bit about suggestibility and how suggestible we are as human beings?
There are so many examples of this. We can do a little meditation right now if our listeners are not in the car or driving, so that you can take a moment to close your eyes. And just take a moment and close your eyes and take a breath or two. And imagine that you've just learned that there's been a lice outbreak where you live, where you work, another member of your household has brought it home, but that it's highly likely that you've been exposed to lice. And I want you to notice the sensations in and around your head right now. Notice whether there might be a little bit of itching, a little bit of a sensation of movement on the scalp, something that might just indicate the presence of lice. And just notice those sensations. Oh, I have good news. Actually, it wasn't your place of work, your place of living. It was somebody else's. We made a mistake. I'm just undoing it because I've done this sometimes and had people scratching all day.
I know. I'm laughing because I'm scratching my head.
Right. And I'm scratching my head as well. Now, it may not be happening for all of our listeners, but a lot of us start to scratch with just that level of suggestion. It doesn't take much. And this is in part because the body is always producing a rich symphony or medley of sensations, most of which we're filtering out most of the time because we don't see them as either interesting and attractive nor threatening. So most of the sensations that we're experiencing most of the time never even ascend to the level of consciousness. But once we're afraid of something, then we become laser focused on that area of the body. We attend to it with a kind of anxious attention and we're off to the races. All it takes is anxious attention applied to any part of the body to start developing symptoms in the body. Maybe I should say a few words about how the chronic pain cycle works, and I think it'll make some sense out of this. Let's go back to back pain like I had. Let's say it's a garden variety case where it starts by just, oh, let's say where I live, it's December, starts shoveling snow for the first time in many, many months, and back gets sore. Okay, so we have some back pain. If I am so unfortunate as to live in a culture that has an epidemic of back pain, in fact, back pain that's been chronic, I may start to worry if my back hurts. I may start to think, uh-oh, I hope this doesn't turn into something like happened to my uncle or happened to my friend or this guy at work. That frightened thought will lead to some changes in the body. Maybe Patricia, you can join me and people at home can join us to just pantomime for a moment. Let's have a little acting class. Imagine that you're feeling really, really scared and just pantomime in your body what that looks like. And we'll even add a little bit of audio.
Ah!
Okay. You do that in your body?
I got it.
Now let's imagine that you're also angry. So pantomime anger in the body. Show what that would look like. We're in a hamming it up acting class. Urgh. And now perhaps frustration. Now, what's happening in your body as part and parcel of those difficult emotions? What do you notice, Patricia, in your own body?
I can feel myself experiencing those emotions when I think about them.
Right. And all of those emotions involve tensing the skeletal muscles of the body. Some tense one part more than the other, but if we're pantomiming it, we're tense in those states. None of these emotions evoke palms up, open, accepting attitude. They're all about tensing the muscles. Once muscles start to tense, they hurt. We've all had this, whether it's the muscles of our neck and shoulder. In fact, friends would, if you're an intimate enough friend, would walk up to one another and just start massaging the shoulders when you hear somebody's had a hard day, or certainly a Charlie horse in our calf muscle. That can hurt like crazy. But we know that it's harmless, but nonetheless, tension creates muscle pain. Now, if the muscle pain increases, that's going to affect our thoughts. The pain's going to get more intense. And we're going to start to think, uh-oh, it's getting worse. Maybe I really did injure myself shoveling the snow. Sooner or later, almost everybody starts to give up activity because I don't want to make it any worse. I don't want to exacerbate my injury. So we start giving up activity. Interestingly, often we give up the very activities that used to bring us a sense of relief from stress, anyway, from tension. We give up vigorous exercise. We might give up dancing or yoga or whatever it might be. And you could see how this can start to turn into a cycle where we've given up the things that help us to relax. We're getting more and more pain sensations. We're reacting to those pain sensations with negative emotions that lead to more tension. And you can get quite caught in this for a long period of time. Sometimes the whole cycle simply begins with a period of emotional distress or an emotional threat. My actual lead hypothesis about what happened, how I got into the back pain problem, I thought it was working out on a cross-country ski machine when I visited my brother, who lives on the opposite coast from me. But when I was visiting him, he had just had a child, and it was where it's only the two of us as siblings, and this was the first child between us. And I think it just shot up my anxiety about, oh, is it time to have kids and what's that going to be like? I don't think that had anything to do with the cross-country ski machine, although I of course thought it was. And in fact, when I got the herniated disc diagnosis, I thought, oh, it's the disc. But in retrospect, what it was I got caught in one of these cycles, and the cycle actually got started during a period of emotional stress, not stress about something bad in this case, but nonetheless, something that was stressful for me. So we see that there's two parts to this. There's the fact that the actual sensations of pain are amplified by our anxiety, like the itching in the head got amplified when I just brought up the suggestion, or like my worry that I've really injured myself, that my spine is damaged, would amplify the back pain. So there's that element of it, but there's also this element in which the very pain itself may be being produced by our emotional reactions.
Yeah, so this gets into when you talk about the anxious attention, and thank you for clarifying the chronic pain cycle, it really starts to underscore the power of story and how your imagination or your thoughts might contribute to all of this. And even you're talking about you have this negative mindset and that makes you feel worse and that makes your original pain feel worse. In mindfulness, we talk a lot about story and thoughts not being almighty. You are not your thought. How does mindfulness help with the negative mindset, the power of story, and hence the pain cycle?
The psychologists refer to this perspective on thought that we can get through mindfulness practice as metacognitive awareness. It's the awareness when a thought arises that it is a thought rather than necessarily a reality. And mindfulness practice cultivates metacognitive awareness in the simplest of ways. Every time that we pay attention to our breath or sounds or other sensations in the body or do a body scan or any one of those practices, and every time a thought arises, we notice the thought, but the usual instruction is gently return your attention back to the anchor, whatever the sensation is that we're using as an anchor. And we'll frequently hear phrases like, allow thoughts to come and go like clouds passing through a vast sky. When we start to watch thoughts this way, and there are mindfulness practices in which we also do thought labeling, in which we note, perhaps it's as simple as just noting thinking every time a thought arises, or there are some in which we create a few little categories like planning, remembering, judging. Every time we take one of these attitudes, whether it's simply centering on the sensations in the body, or it's noticing thoughts deliberately and labeling them in some way, we gain this bit of metacognitive awareness, this perspective. And since these chronic pain cycles have as a central component the thought that it's dangerous to do this or that activity is going to cause distress for me, or I've been told I have a herniated disc and I'm therefore in great danger, whatever the fear-generating thought is, to the extent to which we can see it of, oh, there's another fearful, pain-related thought, rather than just identifying with the thought in reality, we're less likely to get caught by it. It's less likely to generate quite as much emotion, and we're less likely to continue with the same emotional reaction. Now, there's an interesting trope that travels around mindfulness meditation teacher circles, which is, how long does an emotion last if not reinforced by a thought? Mm. You want to take a guess at that, or maybe you know the answer?
I don't know the answer.
The answer that's usually put forth is about 90 seconds. And as a psychologist, I wondered for quite some time, how the heck are you going to measure that? Because it's so natural for our feelings to be accompanied by thoughts. If I'm angry at my friend who I feel has done me dirty in some way, every time I feel the anger, I'm going to have another thought about, I've been so good to you, I can't believe you are so unfair to me. Or if I'm sad about some loss or some rejection or somebody leaving, every time I have the thought, I'll have a wave of sadness. And every time I have the wave of sadness, that's going to generate more sad thoughts. So how could you stop the thoughts enough to test this? Well, it actually comes out of an observation by Jean Bolte Taylor, who was a neuropsychologist who had a left hemispheric stroke. So for a while, she didn't have access to normal narrative thought. And she wrote about her experience. She's lectured about extensively. She says during that time, it was a pretty happy time. She wasn't all that functional, but it was a pretty happy time in many ways. And she noticed that something would happen, would trigger an emotion. But then because she wasn't ruminating about it, the emotion would fade in about 90 seconds. Because an emotion is this rush of bodily arousal, and we feel it. And then it tends to fade if it's not reinforced by a thought. So really what we're doing in mindfulness practice is learning how to not reinforce emotions with further thoughts. And that helps us to not get trapped in them, whether those are the emotions of the day or pain-related emotions, like fear, frustration, and anger that can perpetuate the chronic pain cycle.
We talk about metacognitive awareness, and many people that haven't learned meditation but get caught in this cycle may not have the tools to focus on relieving some of the secondary pain signals that they're getting. What is your recommendation for people, and what type of meditation helps with metacognitive awareness? And will you talk a little bit about, sorry, too many questions at once, but you do want to have medical clearance before you do something that challenges your medical condition.
Absolutely. Let's start with that because that's perhaps the most important. If we're struggling with physical pain, it's always important to get a thorough and competent medical evaluation. As we used to say, fooling around as psychologists, it's very bad form to psychoanalyze a brain tumor. If it's something medical that can be addressed, we of course want to address it. And if it's something where there's danger, we want to know about that danger. Now, the question actually that I suggest to patients to ask their medical provider is a little bit of an unusual question. It's not so much asking the doctor or other provider, what do you recommend I do? It's asking them, do you have good evidence that if I were to return to normal, expectable activities for somebody of my age and my degree of physical fitness, I would do irreparable damage to my body? And that's not the question people typically ask. People typically ask, what should I do? And the doctor, being very well-meaning, will often say, well, I'd avoid this. I'd stay away from that. They're basically giving advice, which is hoping to make the patient more comfortable, not necessarily addressing the question, will I do enduring damage? And the reason why it's important to ask that question is because if the healthcare professional is not thinking that this is a physiological disorder, they're just thinking, well, the thing has to heal and I don't want the person to be in too much distress. But if this is a psychophysiological disorder, a disorder in which the fear and concern about the condition is actually maintaining and perpetuating or exacerbating the condition, then it becomes very important to keep that fear from spiraling out of control. And having medical clearance is, and having the doctor say, no, I don't think you'll damage yourself, then that is enormously important for being able to relax into resuming normal activities. So thank you for highlighting that. The other question about what kind of practice would be helpful, if a person is at all amenable to learning mindfulness practice, then I would introduce mindfulness practice. And there are many ways to do this. A person can take an 8-week MBSR course. They can use the resources that you have on your website. They can take a class at a local meditation center. They can read my materials. I have a book called The Mindfulness Solution, Everyday Practices for Everyday Problems, and any one of these avenues. And if the person doesn't have a serious trauma history or some reason why it's very difficult to sit still and start with an object of attention such as the breath, they can start there and then expand out into body awareness practices such as a body scan, expand out into things like walking and eating meditation, expand out into things like metta or loving kindness practice. Basically, a general introduction for mindfulness practice that you would do broadly. Once a person has established a bit of a practice, then you can start doing specific practices for working with the pain itself. And the bulk of those have the same basic framework to them. It's, if I notice that the pain sensations have risen to a level of intensity that they're now competing with my breath or the food or whatever for my attention, let me simply use the pain sensations as my object of awareness. Let me simply feel the sensations in my back, feel the sensation in my knee, feel the sensation in my belly, wherever I have the discomfort, and breathe with it, allow it to be there. Now, the goal of this is not let me relax to make it go away. The goal of this is let me increase my capacity to simply feel the pain sensations without adding the second arrow, without adding the secondary pain level to it, so that I can feel the pain sensations. Maybe I'll have a reaction of fear. Maybe I'll have a reaction of frustration or anger. Notice that reaction, let go of that reaction, and simply come back to the moment-to-moment sensations of the pain. The more we can develop the capacity to be with pain, the easier this becomes. And I'll tell you an experience early on for me in a meditation retreat. This was decades ago. This was before Eastern equine encephalitis and West Nile virus were mosquito-borne diseases in the Northeast where I live. And I was on a meditation retreat. And at that time, the instructions were, well, do no harm. Don't kill any creatures if you don't have to. And that included meditating outside and being visited by a mosquito. And the experience would be something like this, sitting there meditating, following the breath, and then
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping, available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Oh. And it's when the sound stops that the trouble starts. And sometimes I could actually see the mosquito, let's say, landing on the back of my hand, and it's the female mosquitoes that do this, would dig a little hole in my hand with, I think it's called the proboscis, that pointy thing on the front, inject the anticoagulant and start drinking blood. And you could actually see the back of the mosquito would get bigger and bigger and bigger, would turn red, and she would fly away to use that as a meal to have the energy to lay eggs. And the whole thing, when observed through as part of a mindfulness meditation, is not only not aversive, it's cool. It's like having your own National Geographic film right here, right now in front of you. And I contrast that with what it feels like in a non-mindful attitude where I'm ready to watch the sunset on my front porch, or we've got a picnic and I start to hear and I start swatting and fighting and all of that. And okay, now we do have West Nile virus and Eastern equine encephalitis, so there's a rationale for it, but I used to fight it anyway, even when mosquitoes were safer around here. And that's tremendous suffering instead of a nice National Geographic film. So we can really see when pain isn't too severe, that our attitude toward it plays an enormous role in how much we suffer. And mindfulness practice can really help us to relax into the discomfort. I'll share one other example. Again, discomfort that was rather moderate. But one of my daughters, when she was little, was really, really disturbed by heat and humidity to such a degree that we started giving up and saying, we're just not going to vacation in a hot, humid place. And then one day it was hot and humid around here and she was getting all upset and carrying on. And I'm a mindfulness guy and a psychologist. So I had been suggesting, just feel the sweat, just let it be there. You may find it's not that bad. It's just a set of sensations. And yeah, I'm doing this ever since she's 4 years old, right? And then sometime around age 11, she like gets it. And she says, wow, I finally understand what you're talking about. I just let myself sweat and felt the drops of sweat and felt the heat, and it wasn't so bad. And she later went on to spend a year studying Arabic in Cairo, where it is like really hot and really humid and really unpleasant. And she was pretty okay with it. The air conditioning wasn't even working much of the time. And she was pretty okay with it. So it's a real illustration that this is a skill we can learn.
And do you think it also applies to, we're talking here about chronic pain and physical sensations. Can you work with painful emotions in this same way?
Absolutely. And that's in part because painful emotions are predominantly physical pain. If our listeners would just take a moment right now, and again, if you're not driving a car, and Patricia, join me in this, and just close your eyes a little and just generate a little bit of sadness. Not the saddest thing ever. I don't want you to be overwhelmed, but just something that's a little sad. And feel where in your body you feel it. And just gently place your hand over the part of your body where you feel the sadness, just to feel that. And now let's do the same with anxiety or fear. Not the scariest thing ever, but generate a little anxiety or fear. And place your hand over the part of your body where you feel that. And we can even do this with anger. Think of something that annoys you. If you're a nice person because you're a meditator, just think of members of the other political party, whoever that is for you, and you'll feel some anger. And notice how the anger feels in the body, and place your hand over that. Okay, and you can open your eyes again. So did you notice that these three emotions that can be difficult all have a somatic signature? We actually feel them in the body, and we can locate where we feel them. If we've developed some skill at being with unpleasant sensations in the body, and we can notice that emotions are essentially unpleasant sensations associated usually with either a thought or an image. Some of us would use a thought to generate the emotion. Others might use an image. We start to notice, oh, so all I got to do is apply the same skill here and I'll be okay. I can let myself simply feel the sensations of the emotions. So it's very much, we can use the same kind of approach to work with emotional pain, and we can use the approach to work with emotional distress around the physical pain, the worries about disabilities, the worries. So yeah, I've seen people in terrible distress. Oh, what if I can't take care of my child adequately? What if I'm a drag for my partner? These kinds of pains. So it's very much the same approach that we can use for many different kinds of distress.
Yeah. And in the course, you talk about self-compassion. So I think that applies really well to working with painful emotions. And you have said that chronic pain can feel like a punishment in some people's minds, and that we might blame ourselves in some ways, like I never should have shoveled the snow, or I should have gone to the doctor sooner, or whatever may pop into your head. How can we use self-compassion as a way to care for ourselves when we're in pain, physical or emotional?
Self-compassion is basically trying to be kind to ourselves rather than being critical toward ourselves, and noticing our connection to common humanity rather than isolating ourselves and thinking of ourselves as somehow damaged or separate or bad. And rather than being self-absorbed, allowing ourselves to simply be mindful of what's happening. So self-compassion becomes very, very useful when dealing with both physical and emotional pain, because most of us could use a hug, right? When we're in physical pain or when we're in emotional pain, it is soothing to be in the presence of love and care when we're hurting. And self-compassion is really a way to, or a description of generating that love for ourselves, finding a way to either literally stroke ourselves and give ourselves a hug, remind ourselves that, oh gosh, this is hard to go through this, and connect to others by realizing how many other people are in pain at this moment, because emotional and physical pain, they're built into, you don't want to experience pain, don't get born, because this is simply built into the human condition. So any of these loving and accepting attitudes can help. And as you pointed out, it can be particularly toxic or exacerbating to our situation when we start criticizing ourselves. I brought this on myself. I never should have done it. Or sometimes, really tragically, when people think that they're being punished by God or punished by nature or something because they must have done something wrong, because otherwise, why would they be experiencing this kind of pain?
Yeah, it's so heartbreaking. And are there particular meditations that you recommend for that?
Well, metta practice, which is loving kindness practice, which is taught in most mindfulness courses, is a nice way to begin. I like to do metta practice by first directing the loving kindness toward somebody, some entity who is naturally loving and kind, to prime the pump, if you will. And then imagine that person with us and wishing it to ourselves, and then expanding that out and wishing it to others. Because all of this, when we're practicing loving kindness, it softens the heart. It makes us feel more connected to others and makes us feel a bit loved and loving. Another really nice one, there's a practice from Mirabai Bush. It's called Just Like Me. It's a very simple one that basically, and people can Google it, but it's like, just like me, this is the person who wants to be loved. Just like me, this is the person who's had their heart broken. Just like me, this is the person who has been in physical pain, and go through all the 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows, as they say in Buddhist traditions. And just realizing that, oh yeah, we really are in this together. There's something enormously helpful about huddling together with other human beings and feeling a part of the human family. So often when we're in pain, we feel like we're somehow separate from the rest, and somehow what we're going through is something that others don't experience, whether it's the pain or we're ashamed or we're in emotional distress. And to the extent to which we can realize that, oh gosh, this is our fate as human beings. We are all brokenhearted. We are all struggling. Growing old isn't for sissies. That so much of what we struggle with is existential and universal. There's a real comfort in that, because it's at least we don't have the secondary level of pain of condemning ourselves and isolating ourselves.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said all of that. And I love those practices. I want to just ask another practical question, which is, for people that are feeling pain, do you have any suggestions for people who are also dealing with insomnia, which of course exacerbates everything, physical, emotional, everything?
First, a moment's empathy. It's really hard when we can't sleep, especially when we can't sleep because we're in pain. That said, there are many elements that contribute to insomnia. One of them is that there's a stimulus which is quite strong that's attracting our attention, that's waking us. And whether that's the neighbor making noise next door or the pain in my body, that can make sleep difficult. But there's a secondary loop that takes place in insomnia, which is very similar to the secondary loop or the recursive loop that's in the chronic back pain cycle. Once we haven't slept for a little bit, we start to really notice that, oh gosh, when I don't sleep, I'm cranky, I'm irritable, I can't concentrate as well. So we start to become very attached to the idea of sleeping. And as soon as we get into bed, the thought arises, oh God, I hope this isn't like last night when I couldn't sleep, or I have a lot to do tomorrow, I've got to get to sleep. And there's nothing quite like holding a gun to our heads around getting to sleep to evoke wakefulness. So we need something to interrupt that. And actually, my favorite is simply doing any kind of comforting mindfulness practice before sleep, not with the goal of getting to sleep, simply with the goal of having a restful, mindful time. The way that I usually set this up for my patients is saying, look, you're a busy person. It's hard for you to find time to meditate. This is great. This is an opportunity for an 8-hour retreat. And you simply lie there and follow your breath or another object of awareness. Every time the mind goes off into the thought stream, come back to the sensations. And one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to have a good 8-hour meditation retreat, and that'll be helpful for integrating all sorts of feelings. It'll help you to get some rest. That'll be useful. Or you're going to fail and you'll fall asleep, and that'll be okay because you could use the sleep. So either way, you're going to be okay. And the purpose of this is really to take the gun away from the head, to reassure people that some of the restorative qualities of sleep are achieved with mindfulness practice. Certainly there's bodily rest. There's the opportunity to integrate what's called in dream work, the day residue. In other words, all the thoughts and feelings from the day that might show up in dreams, they're likely to show up in our meditation practice as well. So we're going to get some of the rest that we need. And if we're doing that as an alternative, we're less likely to get involved in the terribly problematic cycle of, I got to get to sleep. I got to get to sleep. Oh, no, I'm still up. Oh, it's 1 a.m. I'm going to be dead tomorrow. All that stuff. For many people who have difficulty taking up mindfulness practices on their own, it can really help to have some kind of a feedback device, particularly a neurofeedback device I had the chance in putting together the course to practice some with the Muse S and see that, oh yeah, even though I'm used to internal neurofeedback, if you will, in other words, simply noticing when my attention is more on the chosen object and noticing my psychophysiology, having the external feedback was definitely helpful. It's another way to gradually and gently train the mind. So for folks who would say, oh, I can't sit and follow my breath, or I hate it, or I get too restless, having a neurofeedback device like the Muse S can also be a good way to go.
Yeah, these are such good tools to implement into your overall program. You talk about how to focus on what really matters in your life and identifying your core values and having daily practices that connect with those core values. What would you offer to really inspire people to take better care of themselves?
There's a lot of literature, research literature, that shows that if you're trying to help people change in a direction which is more helpful, it can be very, very important to, or helpful, just to ask, what matters to you? What's important to do with this life? And interestingly, for most people, the answer comes down to something connected to other people, be a good mom, son, brother, whatever, sister, member of a family, or a good member of a community, or it usually involves in some way wanting to be a decent human being. And it also usually might involve spiritual practice of some sort, whether in a religious framework or outside of a religious framework, but growing wiser and more compassionate in some way. And the question really is for each of our listeners, what most matters to you? And what would you want to be doing with each of your days in order to point in the direction of what matters to you, to have your life be consonant with that in some way? And very interestingly, it helps people to exercise. It helps people to meditate. When people think about what matters, they tend to do what would be helpful for themselves. Also, in terms of the what we're talking about with breaking pain cycles, it also can give us the courage maybe to try to get strong again, to try to rehabilitate ourselves again if a pain problem has kept us from activity, in order to have the strength to do what matters to us in our life.
Yeah. Your contribution to this field is so rich and rewarding, and I appreciate everything that you've done for our course and what you've taught us today. So thank you for being with us today, Ron. I'm grateful for you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much for organizing these different ways to help people struggling with these things.
Great to have Ron with us today. You can find out more about him and his work related to chronic pain at his website, drronsiegel.com. And please join me, Ron, and Shannon Harvey, producer of the film My Year of Living Mindfully, this Friday, May 21st at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for our live Zoom brain health session. I'd love to see you there. You can sign up at choosemuse.com/brainhealth. As always, if you have questions or suggestions for us, please share them at untangle@choosemuse.com. Hope to see you this Friday, and we'll see you next week. We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.